because things were left behind on a desk at the university that made it look like he was still around somewhere, it took 2 weeks for anyone to realize that he was gone. And after that, the case fell into a great deal of chaos. The university police seemed convinced that he had walked away from his life. The family in California insisted he never would have and that he would not have killed himself. So relations got very tense quickly between the family and the university.
Were the Charlottesville police or state police ever involved?
No, they weren't. The city police were eager to be, but they were never invited by UVA, and UVA had absolute jurisdiction. But at the same time, UVA police didn't investigate thoroughly at all, which was so distressing to the parents. They came out here from California and stayed for a month. His stepfather, Clarence Shannon, was a retired big city cop with lots of experience in that kind of case. And there was a big ego clash between the university police and this retired big city police officer.
Was that a disaster from a sort of a forensic investigation standpoint? Was it a real problem that UVA didn't pursue it more aggressively? Would we have known more sooner if they had?
Well, UVA PD is in the interesting position of having been most likely correct on branding him a walkaway. Less defensible, however, was their unwillingness to tell the family why they thought that. They told the family that things were missing, indicative of someone who walked away, but then they didn't specify what those things were. And then when the case got cracked over the summer, they came in after the fact and in public statements to the local daily newspaper made it sound like they had had some role in identifying the remains when they actually had failed to respond to inquiries to get that job done.
It was interesting to me how that job got done. Can one of you explain how it happened that the remains were A, found and B, identified?
The remains were actually found 2 years after Pat disappeared. They were found in upstate New York on the shores of Lake Champlain on a rocky, remote hilltop. They were found by hikers. They were just partial by then. They were able to get forensically a rough outline of that this was a white male about the right age that Pat was, and to extract DNA. But they, for whatever reason, maybe didn't have the technology to enter it onto the national database for missing and unidentified persons until 2007. I was contacted in October 2012 by a woman, Carol Haber, who's a volunteer with the DOE Network. And she had seen my online coverage of the 25th anniversary of Pat's disappearance in 2011 and had been trying ever since to get familial DNA into the national database. But every time she contacted the UVA police, they would ignore her requests for assistance. So, in other words, if anything, they blocked attempts to identify the remains. And so finally, Carol Haber emailed me directly, and I put her immediately in touch with the family in California. The family then contacted UVA, and I guess the police felt they had no option but to go along, and then they assisted in that effort.
Has university policy changed at all over the years in terms of how they handle a crime like this, or a situation like this, I should say?
I think so. I was talking to Jill Harrington, the mother of the murdered Virginia Tech student Morgan Harrington, a few weeks ago, and she told me how when her husband and she discovered that their daughter was missing, they called the University of Virginia Police Department, and the first thing they were told was to contact the Virginia Tech Police Department. And they said, wait a minute, she disappeared from Charlottesville. This is your problem. And UVA PD quickly ceded control to the state police. Now, there has been a bill put forward in the Virginia legislature a few times in the past few years called Catherine's Law. It's based on something that allegedly occurred at UVA, an alleged rape some years ago, which would actually force campus police to cede control in big cases serious crimes, but that law has not passed. But it's something that probably will come up again.
Now, let me just say this about UVA. They actually made that announcement at a press conference that items were missing consistent with a person who had walked away from his life. But they never contacted the family. A reporter asked right away because all the local media knew that nothing was missing. That was the strange thing about this case. Every bit of identification was here in Charlottesville. And the police officer refused to say. Now, you would assume that if they really knew something, they would immediately contact the person's family. Also, they had repeatedly said while the Shannons were here that they could come out to the police department anytime and look at the case file. Well, when the Shannons finally got exasperated, 2 years later, they filed a Freedom of Information Act request, knowing that UVA insisted it was not a criminal matter, and were told they could not see it because it was an active criminal investigation. And they have continued that until my last request, which was probably 3 years ago now.
And how do we know that it was a suicide?
Well, we don't, but it's one of the more interesting collections of circumstantial evidence. What we have is a set of bones found on a beautiful outcropping of rock high up on a steep bluff overlooking scenic Lake Champlain. And we have this man who was, by all accounts, a hard-working graduate student, but he was also a heartbroken fellow who had experienced what his friends say was his first big love in the previous year with a woman who he viewed as his soulmate. He would write her letter after letter, and Barbara here was so prescient in obtaining all of his correspondence with this woman from that period. And what you see is a young man who's writing constantly to the woman he thinks is his soulmate, but unbeknownst to him, she actually has a steady boyfriend who she's about to move to Florida with. And when she finally reveals this to him, he's beyond devastated. He writes her a letter a day for 4 or 5 days in a row, and he writes a poem called The Flight of the Snow Geese. And the snow goose is a bird that mates for life, and I don't think that that was a point lost on him. In fact, it's mentioned in the poem about this pair of birds is traveling north during the springtime, and one has succumbed to the arrow of a hunter, and the other one is crying out while flying north. Well, we did a little research, and we found that one of the main places where snow geese congregate in North America is Lake Champlain. It's right underneath one of their main flyways. It has a lot of water and food, and it offers protection and rest when they're making their migration. And Barbara pointed out to me a few weeks ago that it was on the spring equinox when he placed a phone call. Patrick placed a phone call to Amtrak, and his family dismissed the call to Amtrak as being perhaps not so consequential because he didn't make a reservation. But when you look at the map of Charlottesville and the map of where he ended up, you see that in Charlottesville there's an Amtrak station less than 2 miles from Pat's house. And up in Port Henry, New York, there's an Amtrak station right on Lake Champlain, less than 2 miles from where his remains were ultimately found. And in that era, before there were strong security measures, you could buy an Amtrak ticket with cash and no identification. You could buy it on board. And Pat made a couple of cash withdrawals from his bank account in the days leading up to his disappearance. One was for a couple $100s, one was for $40, and the sum of those is far more than the cost of a one-way ticket in that era to Port Henry, New York from Charlottesville. And then the fact that the remains were found with syringes nearby certainly suggests that something other than natural causes might have happened. In fact, one of the people I interviewed for the story I wrote was Pat's great hiking buddy, a now retired doctor living in Michigan, who, when told about all these circumstances, again, it's just circumstantial, but they're powerful circumstances. You have a broken heart. You have a fascination with snow geese. You work in physiology, so you have access not only to syringes but to the medicines that might go in them. And you start to see a picture emerge of a death or an escape from your life that was probably intentional.
I have a little different take. I absolutely agree with Hawes. I do believe that, sadly enough, Pat set up this intricate scene in Jordan Hall, leaving all his things like his ID and glasses and keys and everything. But I think that in addition to his grief over the relationship having failed, I discovered in 1997 in my investigation by talking to a next-door neighbor that he apparently was being stalked by a man. And I think there is some suggestion that Pat may have been questioning his sexuality. And I suspect that being as sort of emotionally needy as we know he was from the letters in the poem, I suspect that he may have hooked up with someone, possibly someone he met at Mem Gym, which in that era especially was a very aggressive cruising spot for gay men in the locker room, may have been attracted to someone and then realized that the person was literally stalking him and couldn't get rid of him. I suspect that that was very threatening to him. He may have really feared that they would find out, for instance, in his department or something. So I think it was a mix of things, but I do agree that, sadly enough, I think that he did just feel he couldn't go on any longer.
I want to add one more important thing to that mix of things, and that was Pat had gotten a C+ on a major exam shortly before he disappeared, which was an uncharacteristically low grade for him. And in his last letter to the young lady that he pined for, he told her that he felt like a fern in a forest of sequoias. And so if he were feeling intimidated by the program, which had some of the brightest stars in the physiology world, that combination of being daunted in a tough department might have compounded his misery. In fact, one of the people I consulted for my article, a psychiatrist, said, yeah, if life is love and work, Pat might have felt like he was failing at both of them.
At this point, where do you go with the story? Do you just close the book? Do you feel like whatever needs to be changed is changed? Whatever issues you had raised over the years in connection with this case are resolved?
I certainly don't. I'm writing a book about the case. One thing that has struck me is that though it looks like the university police, as Hawes said, were correct, their behavior toward the family was egregious. This was the year after Liz Sicuro had been raped in a fraternity house at UVA, which she wrote a book about. And both she and her father claimed that when they went to the UVA police of that era, they were urged not to press charges. The day after Pat's absence was discovered, a young woman was murdered at Lehigh University, Jean Cleary, and her parents sued the university and won after finding out that Lehigh had known there was a problem with security at the dorms and had done nothing. The family founded a foundation called Security on Campus, and that's the group that pushed through national and state legislation that colleges and universities have to publicize crime statistics. I suspect that UVA was under tremendous internal pressure not to have any bad marks.
And that probably hasn't changed. I mean, I think all universities have that tendency to want to protect their institutional reputation.
That's why Jill Harrington, the mother of Morgan Harrington, says that universities have an inherent conflict of interest and should not be investigating themselves.
Let me just back up and cover a little bit of ground that I wondered about. Why do we suppose he left things behind? Was that just an oversight, like I'm leaving my life behind?
No.
I think it was a plot.
Yeah.
Like, there was meat left out on the drain board in his kitchen, and there were the grapefruit that his elderly landlady had given him left at his study carrel. And this was a guy who put a note up on the study room door saying, this door must be locked at all times when you're not in it. And his keys were in his book bag or on the top of the carrel. It's like he left everything so it would take a while to figure it out. And he was benefited in this from a couple of compounding factors, one being that his elderly landlady fell sick. Was it that Sunday,
the next day
after he made his last ATM transaction, and was hospitalized for a couple weeks? And then also he was new in town, wasn't really well known to that many people, so people were a little slow to pick up on his absence. And then thirdly, his parents were off in Korea on a visit for returning service people during the Korean conflict. And so the people who might have been in contact with him just weren't able to see or talk to him. And so his disappearance went undetected for quite a while.
And the sad part is, and I can't help but think that in addition to just not wanting it to be obvious at all that he had killed himself, I think there may have been some anger underlying that. It's very clear that the actual choice of Lake Champlain was, and the psychiatrist Hawes talks to agrees, very clearly a message to the girlfriend, but I also think to his family as well. He had grown up at the hands of a brutal alcoholic father who himself was murdered. I think Pat had survived and survived and survived as long as he could, and he finally said he could not take it anymore. And I think that setting that tableau up that way at home and in Jordan Hall, I can't help but think that there was some form of wanting to sort of get some revenge. I don't think he ever guessed that it would snowball into really ruining his parents' lives from never knowing what happened.
How do you two feel as writers having this kind of closure? Are you relieved?
I have to admit, it's kind of satisfying to get some answer, because for years, Barbara and I would talk and be frustrated about how we figured we would never know what happened to him, because we had a police department that wasn't really investigating, and we had a case that had just grown so cold that it every year seemed to dim the chances that it would ever be solved.
I never gave up hope. Now, I firmly believed, like the family did, I firmly believed Pat had been murdered and was very vocal about that. I never gave up hope that someday his remains would be found. But when I found out they had been, I called Hawes and right away and said, "Are you sitting down?"
Yeah,
it was shocking.
And Barbara was real nice to let me have a chance to write a long-form treatment of it, which I got published in an upstate New York newspaper. And so that was satisfying for me, because I had been her editor and she had been the one who had written the articles all along. So it was very rewarding for me to be able to write this and get the feedback from friends and family. And you know, the words of Pat's brother are so powerful. And they make you realize how, even if you don't know exactly what led the person to their death, and even though you're traumatized that they are dead, finding out where the remains are is a key moment in being allowed to grieve. And what Michael Shannon, Pat's brother, said was, "We feel like we've won the lottery." Mm-hmm. And it's a tragic statement, because It's a sad lottery, but you understand when you talk to other parents and family members of victims, that period of not knowing, it's not only terror, but it's the terror of limbo. And it's got to be a terrible, terrible thing.
Hawes was absolutely brilliant in his detective work here at the very end, putting the pieces together. And also Courtney Stewart, and also a local editor, helped with that. I have set up a website. I did that several years ago at patcollinscase.com, and it has a link to Hawes's article, which is just terrific.
Your article was also kind of eye-opening in that this group, Doe, is dealing with a huge number of people who are missing and a huge number of remains that are not identified.
Yeah, and really, like, the big hero in all this is Carol Haber, this volunteer for the Doe Network,
yes,
who read Barbara's article online and just got haunted by the case and felt like, his parents needed that closure. And so even though she was living in Pennsylvania, she was the area coordinator for Virginia, and she reached out to try to get the family to give familial DNA. And they made that preliminary indication in August, and then they got confirmed it with mitochondrial in October. And last I talked to the people involved, his remains were heading back to California.